Okay, so let's start by saying thanks very much to Cliff and Neil for inviting me here to give these talks, and it's a great pleasure to be here and enjoy some of this wonderful weather. Okay, so my title... The difference is you can cope with it. England falls apart. Okay, so the title of my talk is Aspects of Moduli in String Compactifications. And so there's going to be three talks, one today, one tomorrow, and one the day after that. And so I've written up here the basic rough outline for how topics I intend to cover and where I intend to cover them. So let me also right at the beginning say I generally prefer talks to be interactive. That means I particularly encourage you to interrupt me, to disagree with me, to make comments, to do anything other than just sort of, sit there blindly looking at your watch and wondering when lunch is. Okay. Okay, so, right. So let me just, run through what the schedule is going to be. Okay, so the first thing, I want to start basically by saying, what are moduli and why are they important? So, I think this is good, because personally, I think that moduli physics is kind of, if you want to be kind of going from string theory to particle physics, via a BSM route, then understanding the physics of moduli is really kind of one of the most important things one has to do along the way. So after the introductory motivation, I then want to say something briefly about moduli effective actions, and then moduli stabilization and supersymmetry breaking. Because moduli stabilization, in some sense, really kind of underlies all the rest of moduli physics. And then a bit about kind of how moduli couple and their roles in axions and cosmology. The second lecture where we talk more, the basic theme of the second talk will basically be flavor. So this will be both how the effective action basically constrains the way moduli can appear in Yukawa couplings, and so and what constraints you can get on the form of Yukawa couplings in string compactifications. And then the second part of the flavor thing will be Suzy flavor questions, in particular the question of Suzy flavor universality. And we're here, I think, where the structure of the moduli effective action, and particularly what you get from Kalabi-Yau's, sort of systematically goes against kind of naive effective field theory expectations. And then the final part, the third talk, would be on threshold corrections, where I think there's kind of a very nice story where you can get very surprising results using low energy supergravity, which you can then confirm with a string picture. Okay, but let's start at the very beginning. Okay, so what are moduli? Okay, so string theory, obviously, we know likes to live in 10 dimensions rather than 4 dimensions. So the most basic kindergarten part of string phenomenology is that you need to compactify string theory from 10 dimensions down to 4 dimensions. And in the string universe, that 10 dimensions goes to 4 dimensions across 6 dimensions. And basically, for my purposes, the 6 dimensions are going to be a Kalabi-Yau manifold throughout. So there are definitely alternatives to do this. You don't have to have a Kalabi-Yau. What Kalabi-Yau gives you is you have low energy supersymmetry in a reasonably straightforward way, which is appealing both for its phenomenological purposes and for the control it gives you. There are more general ways of getting low energy supersymmetry, but I've decided that those are going to be outside the scope of these talks. So something like warped Kalabi-Yau, things like, say, non-geometric background, or things like twisted tori. Yeah, I don't have anything against them, but I'm not going to talk about it. This is going to be, the extra dimensions are going to be Kalabi-Yau's, and what I'm going to talk about, in terms of moduli, are the moduli associated to Kalabi-Yau's, And particularly, you know, some of the lots of the structure, like the way Kähler moduli and complex structure moduli appear, are going to play kind of important roles. There may be kind of, you know, there may be similar physics that occurs for other non-Calabi-Yau manifolds or non-geometric manifolds, but yeah, that's beyond the scope of what I know well enough to be able to talk about. No, I'm not excluding. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so given that we have extra six-dimensional space, the six-dimensional space has dynamics and deformations of the extra-dimensional geometry give scalar fields in four dimensions. And in particular, the cases we're interested in are the massless deformations, i.e. zero mode, which become massless scalar fields, or at least scalar fields that start off massless, which are moduli. Okay, so my basic rough working definition of moduli throughout these talks are going to be the deformations of the extra-dimensional geometry that appear as, in four dimensions, on Kaluza-Klein reduction, as massless, uncharged scalar fields. The most so far, this is a completely classical. To some degree, I mean, there's an awful lot of really kind of interesting, important physics. It's simply in, yeah, classical compactification and the classical structure of Calabi-Yau. Yeah. I mean, for some things like stabilization, I'm definitely going to need to get quantum mechanical. But one can go a long way without getting quantum mechanical. Okay, so I'm also going to be particularly interested in the geometric deformations of Calabi-Yau. So let me just briefly view and recall what these are. So a Calabi-Yau solves the equations of motion. What is a Calabi-Yau manifold? A Calabi-Yau is a Ricci flat Taylor manifold of vanishing class. Yeah, actually, that's probably all a bit tautological. Okay, no, probably a Calabi-Yau. Yeah, once you have the Kähler manifold of vanishing first Chern class, then Yau's theorem guarantees the existence of a Ricci flat metrics. Okay, so but the Calabi-Yau is a Kähler manifold and it emits a Ricci flat metric. Yau's theorem basically tells us that this metric, given the manifold, the metric is unique. It both exists, the Ricci flat metric exists and is unique up to two things. First of all, the choice of the Kähler form. And secondly, the choice of the complex structure. So if we compactify strings from 10 dimensions down to 4 dimensions, what this is saying is, you know, the well-known fact that Calabi-Yau solves the equations of motion. But given a Calabi-Yau, there are various kind of families of Calabi-Yaus we can move along. And these Calabi-Yaus are parameterized by varying the Kähler form and varying the complex structure of the club, yeah? And given that there are these two basic parameters, there are the two basic, these are the two basic geometric types of moduli. So geometric moduli of Pilar Biao's are the Kähler moduli associated to Kähler form. So this is the Kähler form can be expanded in the basis of 1-1 forms, and the moduli are the coefficients of the expansion. Much more physically, the moduli are the size of two cycles inside the Pilar Biao. So specifying the Kähler moduli is equivalent to specifying the sizes of all the two cycles in the Pilar Biao. And in terms of metric deformations, these are zero modes, which are 1-1 zero modes, and the Kähler moduli are associated to zero modes of 1-1 forms in the Pilar Biao. The other large class of moduli are the complex structure moduli. And these are associated to symmetric deformations that are either completely holomorphic or completely anti-holomorphic. If you have a deformation such as this, this is moving you away from the standard form of the Kähler metric. So these are changing the complex structure. And from these, you can contract them with the holomorphic or anti-holomorphic 3-0 form. And if you do this, you see that the indices are basically, there's one holomorphic indices and two anti-holomorphic. So these are associated to either 2-1 or 1-2 forms. Okay, now, you're all very clever, but I'm not necessarily. So there's a picture for myself, which I always carry in my head, which is a very basic picture of what these things correspond to. So if you have a donut, there are two ways of basically deforming a donut. So one is you supersize it. So you take the whole donut and make all dimensions bigger. And the other is to kind of squeeze it in such a way as to making it like a hula ring or something. And this kind of supersizing, where you basically change the overall size, you change, but you keep the shape the same, is a Kähler deformation. And this kind of squeezing is basically a complex structure deformation. And so for this reason, Kähler and complex structure deformations are often things of as size and shape deformations. Okay, let me also note at this point, but I'll talk about more detail a bit later, that these moduli, these geometric moduli, should be complexified in string theory by the inclusion of the anti-symmetric form fields. So the moduli, or at least can be complexified by form fields. So in particular, the Kähler moduli are naturally complexified. Well, say in the heterotic string, are naturally complexified by including the anti-symmetric two form, and so you have So this is the volume of a two-cycle. And this basically is coming from you integrate B over the two-cycle. And the final kind, well, not final, but of the modulus that I'll be talking about is the Dillerson modulus, which is the string coupling. This isn't geometric because it's associated to the string expansion parameter, G string. And this is complexified by incorporating with a zero form. There are also other moduli, which I'm going to just put as outside the scope of what I'm going to talk about. So that you can have bundle moduli associated deformations of vector bundles present in the compactification, brain moduli associated to brain positions, and probably others. But these I'm just going to say now, I'm not going to talk about. So C0 is a zero form. So in the case I'm going to be most looking at, which is type 2b, it's the Ramond zero form from the closed string RR sector. It complexifies the string coupling in the same way that things like two forms complexify the geometric. But okay, sorry, yeah, thank you. Yes. So whether it's one over G string squared or one over G string will depend on the string theory. So the action of a d minus one instanton is e to the minus phi, and that's one over g string. And the simplest way to always think about what the modulus is what's the action at an appropriate frame. Okay. I mean, I think yeah, in the heterotic string, okay, they would have to go. Yeah, it would have to go as one over.
It's not a choice of not really to talk about these other things. Is there any? If you manage to stabilize and solve all the problems for these geometric modulations, does that at all imply that you've also fixed the problems for these, or do you have to still go back and think about all these? It's just you're not talking about them because of time, rather than because of the problems.
Yeah, so you do have to think about these as well. Okay, so reasons for not thinking about these are so for some of the geometric moduli, some of the problems are more serious. Okay, because for example, the overall volume, yeah, has got a decompactification direction. And the string coupling's also got a decompactification direction. With something like a brain position, yeah, you can kind of see that if you have a space and you've got a brain, yeah, the potential for, yeah, if there is a potential, it will have a minimum, because if it's on a compact space, that will have a minimum somewhere. So that's one reason why these, I think, are slightly less important than the geometric moduli. And the other reason is these, you can avoid having. So you can avoid, you know, you don't have to have wandering brains in a compactification. Whereas the geometric moduli, I think, are always. So I agree, you know, one ought to think about these as well. But I think they're slightly less important than the geometric ones, which is why I'm going to focus.
But when you do modular stabilization, you have to include both at the same time. You cannot just stabilize killer moduli and ignore what you call brain moduli.
So this is why I was saying, for example, yeah, I mean, one reason for, yeah, is that the fact that the brain are moving on a compact space, that if you have, you know, that potential will have a minimum somewhere. Yeah, I mean, obviously, ideally one has a single thing which does everything, which does give you every aspect you're looking for. But given the, you know, I'm going to have to restrict to some extent on what we're going to talk about, how, you know, these are the restrictions I'm going to make.
Your applications are always smooth,
not singular. Basically, yes. I mean, you know, one could imagine, certainly have things like orbifold singularities, but
if it's singular, it's the same, it will have a minimum somewhere.
I think so, yeah. I mean, a brain that's an orbifold singularity is a perfectly happy object.
I think the objection is that if you really want to get a really stiff particle physics model, and you're going to have to stick frames in there, and kind of postponing the issue of frames.
Okay, but if you have brains there, they don't necessarily have moduli. Yeah, just because you've got a brain in there doesn't mean that the brain's got a moduli.
You're rapidly biased.
Well, sometimes you will and sometimes you won't. It depends on.
Well, you can say the same thing about closing moduli, and then you choose your
particular variable. Okay. So I think a rigid divisor is far more common than a rigid Calabi out. Yeah, I don't think that's a controversial thing.
So can you remind me what computes by the coupling constant for F2A and F2A?
So I'm going to write these out shortly. So.
Okay.
Okay, so the basic issue, well, one of the most basic issues of moduli is that moduli are massless at tree level and, well, naively so would give if forces and so must be stabilized. Okay, so
they're always there.
Something which is massless with the Planckian suppressed, with the regular Planckian suppressed coupling is in problem.
But the only way you could really, I might have to object to this way of phrasing it because to get something that light be relevant to the test, at the classical level you can do it, but it's really hard to have the quantum effects.
Okay, I agree with you. I mean, okay, and also we'll get masses on Susie breaking. That is also a true. Yeah, I don't mind which way one looks at this, but.
But the motivating it by fifth forces, that's the least your problem.
I don't mind which is the least of our problems, as long as you agree that there is a problem. Okay, any just small questions before I continue with the same? Why I think moduli are so important. Okay, so why do I think the moduli sector is both important and interesting. Okay, so the first reason is.
So let me just take a little bit more issue. I think there are some moduli in models which essentially would couple identically to all atoms. Those aren't a problem. It's any difference between the forces that you still, the test of the equivalence principle.
Okay, so yeah.
Limits are 10 to minus 3 dimensions. No, because there will be plenty of suppressions due to quantum masses. So just take the coupling for the stress density, beta, T, U, for example, the dilaton.
It's the coupling squared relative.
So you're squaring
it. So
I mean, my understanding when I last looked at this is step will be able to take
the step
minus six. step will take the step minus six, so then it's getting a bit positive.
Okay, so Neil, would you be happy if I replaced must by strongly suggests?
No. Ten minus three is not a very small number. No.
Okay, I'm afraid I'm just going to carry on.
While we're harping on this, so Cliff said that this is the fifth word is the least of your problem. So most of your problem you're referring to like time variation.
Okay. He only has this problem if he doesn't break surface the effort. But then he doesn't get anything right. And so getting down to the fifth force, the sensible energies, the first problem would be why did he break surface the effort? If you break it to the weak scale, then all these scalars are going to want to have passed the weak scale limit. Yeah. So it's actually hard to get. If you want to actually have a light scalar, you have to work to get it. Like, that's what the progress is.
So when you said it was the least of your problems, do you have in mind a what is the bigger problem?
How do you break supersymmetry and what's the spectrum?
Okay, so let me. Okay, so why do I think these are things are moduli are important? Okay, so I'm not by saying that moduli are important. I'm not saying that other stuff isn't important, but I do want to stick to my guns that this is important. Okay, so first of all, moduli are generic. They're one of the most generic elements of string compactifications. That pretty much, however, whichever way you try and compactify string theory or you try and connect string theory to the standard model, you're going to be dealing with moduli. So yeah, they're always there. Secondly, the moduli sector takes the same basic form for all Pilar BLs. So yeah, I mean, obviously we know there are kind of millions of Pilar BLs, but they've all got Kähler moduli. They've all got complex structure. Well, all got complex structure moduli. Okay, almost all have got. Yeah, if one has a rigid one, it doesn't have. But yeah, almost all of them have got both Kähler and complex structure moduli, and the moduli effective actions look very similar in all the cases. And so a kind of anti-landscape point that my feeling, so is that if there are any universal or quasi-universal results of string compactifications, they will come from the moduli sector because of this property that the way the moduli sector behaves is very similar across lots of different Pilar BLs. Portrait of who, Cliff? Okay. The waffle sort of used by landscape is that you can never get anywhere because anything you want, you can always get. Whereas I think something like the effective action of moduli takes a pretty generic form across all of the Pilar BLs, and all however many hundred million Pilar BLs. Okay. And two, the moduli, they enter crucially into all BSM questions in string theory. So if one is interested in BSM physics and thinks that the world might be described by string compactification, then I think you need to really deal with the physics of moduli. So in particular, and in no particular order, these questions include Suzy breaking, flavor, inflation if you like it, and alternatives if you don't, and all questions to do with cosmology. Well, and let's add axions here as well. So if the world is a string compactification, then I think one needs to engage with the moduli sector and moduli physics if one wants to kind of think about a lot of what are traditionally BSM questions. And thirdly, if I was going to say, why bother with string theory? Why not just do effective field theory? I think, this is something I'm going to elaborate on throughout all these talks, that the added value of strings, that string theory reaches the parts effective field theory doesn't, that there's a systematic violation of naive effective field theory expectation as to how these fields couple and how they behave. Beyond the standard model. Okay, any other questions or disagreements on that?
No, I mean kind of generic, but you have to learn
there. So where?
When you say systematic violation of naive expectations, you mean like some generic thing, you won't get generic.
Yes, so things like we say, you know, write down all operators that are allowed by the symmetries with order one coefficients. Yeah, that kind of argument I think kind of systematically fails when dealing with logic. Yeah.
What kind of stuff do you have in mind for the universal result? Could it be something topological, such as the number of flavors?
Let me see. So if one was going to have some kind of model and say that, you know, so obviously one of the problems with string model building is the question of, you know, there are just millions of Calabi yaws, so there are millions of ways of putting brains down. Yeah, so if you want to have some kind of result which you can put forward and you say, you know, this is a genuine prediction of, you know, of something, you know, which isn't just tied to saying, well, some sense, you know, I've got a different Calabi yaw, a different set of fluxes, you know, something like that, then I think, to my mind, you know, I think the moduli sector is the best bet for getting something like that. You have to have something where you could say, well, it really doesn't matter what Calabi yaw you have there, for example.
I mean, we understand the geometrical aspects of Calabi yaw manifolds really well, and I just cannot think of anything that obviously could. I guess it suggests itself as an observable, which is common to all moduli spaces of Calabi yaw manifolds. That's why I asked. Maybe.
Okay, so once it will fill. Okay, so there are. Okay, so there are two main types of moduli. Taylor and complex structure. And the Taylor moduli are associated to two or four cycles in the Calabi yaw, so two or four dimensional submanifolds, and the complex structure is associated to three cycles. Okay, so I also specialize to n equals 1 compactifications And so I just want to write up some definitions of the moduli for different classes of n equals 1 compactifications. So the case I'll be most interested in, the case of type 2b with D3 and D7 brains. And here the Kähler moduli are defined as so each Kähler modulus you get by taking the volume of a four cycle divided by the string coupling is the real part of the modulus, and the imaginary part of the modulus is the Ramond-Ramond four-form field integrated over that same four cycle. The complex structure can be got by integrating the holomorphic three-form over a three-cycle. And the dilaton from 1 over string coupling complexified by the Ramond-Ramond zero form. So often the... Yeah, so why these are the correct holomorphic definitions of the moduli, isn't immediately clear at first. The easiest way to work that out normally is if you think about the action of the appropriate instantons in the theory, because the action of the instanton has to be holomorphic in the moduli. So if you think about what this is here, this is basically comes from the action of a Euclidean D3 brain. If you take a D3 brain as an instanton wrapping on a four cycle, and then you think that what does its action look like? This gives you the holomorphic, the correct holomorphic coordinates to describe the modulus. And this is the same with a D minus one instanton. Type 2A. D6 brains and O6 planes. Here, the Kähler modulus is so here, okay, so with 2A, you have the Kähler moduli effectively are corresponding to the actions of Wilczy instantons. The complex structure moduli are basically corresponding to the action of E2 instantons, Euclidean two brains wrapping three cycles. And the dilaton is pretty similar to the complex structure moduli. And
what cycle generate?
Sorry? I forget exactly. It's pretty similar to the complex structure moduli. I don't think there's a really clear distinction there between how you define the dilaton and how you define the complex structure moduli.
Why is only D3,
Euclidean
D3 playing a role in the
Kähler?
Could I not imagine some other D-string
wrapping around? Yes, so you could imagine like D1s and D5s. But the fact this is these are D3, D7 compactifications is basically what's giving me the restriction to that it's Euclidean D3. I mean, if it was a D5, D9 compactification, then precisely as you say, then you'd get the holomorphic moduli by looking at D1 strings, basically wrapping cycles.
Would I get n equals to 1?
Yes, yeah. D5, D9 is perfectly Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it's historical, but there's much more tension on D3, D7 than D5, D9. But. And.
So it's quite confusing. Yep. Irrespective of what D brings, you put in, those cycles are going to be there. So it'll be moduli.
Yes, okay, so but the two cycles and the. So the question is really what's the holomorphic description of the moduli? So in the low energy supergravity, you've got certain moduli, and then which the superpotential has to be holomorphic with respect to those fields. Now, geometrically, like two cycles and four cycles are dual to one another. So there isn't more information in knowing the volumes of the two cycles compared to the volumes of the four cycles. And finally, heterotic. So here, the Kähler moduli basically come from the Roche instantons and the, in this case, the dilaton is given by the volume of the whole of the Kolarbi-Yau, plus by the closed string coupling, and then that's complexified by the universal. So you can impart. So this is essentially the real part of omega. Now the thing is, so because omega calibrates the cycle, so this is essentially the same as integrating the real part of omega. But the reason, the thing is, that you only get one modulus from omega in 2A, in type 2A. Yeah, so your interval is projecting out half of what you had in 2B. So you only, you know, so that's why it's not really omega. Well, it is omega. It's the real part of omega, but omega is acting as a calibration form on the side. Any more questions? The universal axion, I think, is B mu nu, which complexifies the dilaton. So B is the NSNS two form field with its indices in four dimensions. And again, one could, because it's a two form, it's equivalent to a scalar. Okay, so what are the important things to note? So this is something now that's going to come, I'm going to come back to again and again. Shift symmetries, which are wonderful because they are powerful and they give you far more information than they should do about the effective action. Okay, so in 2B, note that the Kähler moduli have a shift symmetry under which their imaginary part is shifted. This shift symmetry corresponds to shifting an RR field, and because perturbative strings don't couple to Ramon-Ramon fields, this is good to all orders in string perturbation theory. And in 2A, the same holds for the complex structure moduli, and the same is true. It shouldn't be a surprise that in 2B this is applying to the Kähler moduli, and 2A applying to the complex structure moduli. There's a basic symmetry in the effective actions. That roughly, essentially, what holds in 2B holds in 2A, where you interchange the Kähler and complex structure moduli. And of course, this is the effects of mirror symmetry. So just flagging up, so the importance of I'm going to, again, as I said, come back to this again in the end, but the basic importance of these shift symmetries is that these symmetries, the fact you have a symmetry that is good to all orders in perturbation theory, are basically going to mean that the moduli that has the shift symmetry cannot appear in the perturbative superpotential. So it can only appear in the superpotential non-perturbatively, i.e. via exponential effects. And this fact then has significant constraints on effective actions. So, for example, Yukawa couplings are mostly generated by the superpotential. And the fact that, say, the T moduli in type 2B cannot appear in the superpotential Yukawa couplings will then significantly constrains what the possible allowed forms of Yukawa couplings in string magnifications can be. And let me also say at this point that while this is like the two, you have very similar structures in all of kind of 2B, 2A, heterotic, and so on. I'm going to focus on D3, type 2B with D3 and D7 here.
Sir, are you saying that for all K in 2B, for all K moduli, there is shift symmetry?
Yes. Yeah.
In 2A for all complex structure?
Yes.
Why is that?
So because the imaginary part of the modulus in 2B you get by integrating a Ramon-Ramon form over the cycle. Now, perturbative strings, only D-brains couple to Ramon-Ramon forms. So perturbative strings have no couplings to Ramon-Ramon fits. So if you change the value of this, i.e. you change the Ramon-Ramon form, that gives you absolutely no difference at all to any perturbative string.
The same is true for complex moduli.
And the same is exactly the same is true for complex structure moduli. In type 2A.
Another question, so why doesn't the universal Dirichlet appear as 2B or 2A?
So there is a Dirichlet in...
The universal axiom.
Oh, okay, so it's something like this. So this is, in some sense... Okay, so in heterotic, well, the universal axiom is this comes from this two-form B field. Now, in this 2B, D3, D7, in at least this kind of form that I've got it here, that field is just projected out of the string spectrum. So if it's projected...
So in 2A you have
an
oriented fold, but...
In 2B there's an oriented fold, this is an oriented fold. And so there are also 03 and 07. Thanks. Okay, any questions before I carry on? Okay, so given that we have moduli, we basically want to know their effective action. So we have massless uncharged scalar fields, and we want to know how they appear in the Lagrangian. Well, if we have a low energy supersymmetric theory, then we have Kähler potentials and superpotentials. So the key quantities are, so let me write up. Okay, just let me write that. We want the Kähler potential and superpotential as a function of the moduli. Okay, so I'm sorry, Will, out of white chalk, so.
There is sponge underground.
I I think we're still going to be out for quite short. So, thanks. Thanks. Okay, so C. We have a Taylor potential.
Can I just ask what maybe a silly question?
That's always dangerous when it's
done. Why do these fields only depend on four dimensional coordinates? Is there integrals over less than six dimensions?
So each of these integrals, so there's some cycle in the Calabi-Yau. And so in four dimensions, what we're seeing is basically the volume of that cycle. So the four-dimensional scalar field is basically the volume of this cycle. So okay, yeah, so this integral, for example, so this is the integral over the four cycle here of the determinant of the metric. So you mean that there are six dimensions in total in the problem? Yeah, okay, so but in the six dimensional space you have various four dimensional submanifolds and two dimensional submanifolds. And from our non-compact four dimensions, what we see as scalar fields are basically the volumes of these submanifolds, not the volume of the overall space. Does that make?
Just the volume of the submanifold depend on where it's located.
That's what's bothering. We've seen it move around.
So homologically, these things are cycles. So there's a minimum volume representative of that cycle.
So when you minimize, are you saying the other direction is less?
So suppose we had a torus. So here's the equivalent of a one cycle inside a torus. And there are many representatives of this one cycle. So this would be another representative. And the statement is that the modulus is the minimal volume of that one cycle. So you explore everywhere and you'd find, and this is the minimum volume. And the value of the four-dimensional scalar field is the volume of the minimal size representative of that one cycle. I don't think it's. I mean, I think there has to be a minimum. I mean, given that there is. That's like one cycle's got a well-defined size. Yeah. I mean, it's the size of the cycle that matters. I mean, even if the torus is completely flat, for example, this is another representative of that one cycle which is bigger than this one. So there is a unique number, which is the minimal size of that cycle. And that is the modulus. I mean, another way to think about this is that the modulus, if you wrap a brain on it, because brains have got tension, the brain will just automatically find the minimal area cycle. Well, yes. So the size of the cycle could be zero. In which case, the size of the cycle is zero. Yeah, this is what happens at a singularity. Yeah.
The brain is efficient finding the minimum functionality. It's classic for that, but it doesn't necessarily find the smallest place. Definitely, it finds the smallest configuration. That may not be the location in the higher dimensional space that it's small. I mean, is there a dynamics
in determining this at all? So you got this. Are there any dynamics, or is it just a definition? It's a definition. There's no dynamics here. This is just given a Calabi-Yau manifold. You know, given a homological representative of a cycle, that's got a definite, definite sense.
The dinosaur could have taken this thing and said, I just take span metric over and look for all these solutions to look for which equation those are harmonic angles you're using the fact of the, I guess, type of cycles.
Yeah.
You could have written the volume in terms of the Kähler form. Then the Kähler form is closed, so...
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so the Kähler form calibrates the cycles, yeah.
So if that's just the definition of the module, why is that minimum volume? Is there some way of saying why the minimum volume is the relevant problem?
So the picture I have is that of the brain. Is that in some sense that yeah, the holomorphic definition of a modulus is tied to the yeah, to if you put a brain on what the action of that brain is. That's the picture I have.
Okay. So in that case then that would introduce dynamics. The dynamically select the location, right?
Maybe the thing you're getting at is it sounds like this is a very partial description. Because you're saying describe the entirety. Just one
science
or a few.
So yes, so this is zero mode. So there are lots of polluted Klein modes. Yeah, and we just integrated them out and removed those. Yeah, this is we're just looking at the zero modes. Yeah. No, I don't think this is dimensional reduction, taking the and getting the zero modes, and these are the zero modes of the metric. No, I mean, these are counted by the homology classes of the Calabi-Yau, which just counts the number of solutions to the Lignerowicz equation, which is the equation for massless metric modes.
In the classical geometric Calabi-Yau moduli space, as explained in the famous that's a little bit different from what you're writing here. So I guess it's the difference is comes from the D3, D7 brains.
Yeah, so that's basically much more similar to the heterotic. If you look,
oh, right,
yeah.
I see, okay.
Yeah. I mean, and if you do straight type 2 compactifications,
right,
then that also ties in.
So that leads me to my next question, yeah. How is the dimensionality of the various subspaces of the moduli space of that related to this? Right? Is there something you're going to explore somewhere? Are they different, the
modular spaces of themselves? So, I mean, other than the difference between being moving down from n equals 2 supersymmetry to n equals 1 supersymmetry, and that you're projecting half of the multiples of each case, no, they're the dimensional. So
I can think of that.
Yeah. Okay, so we have Kähler potentials and superpotentials, and the couplings to matter. So C are denoting matter fields, and phi are denoting moduli fields. And these parts here are the purely moduli self-couplings. So these are important for moduli stabilization and supersymmetry breaking. And these parts are the couplings of moduli to matter. So these are important for flavor physics, i.e. what is the Yukawa couplings, and also the computation of soft terms. So if the moduli break supersymmetry, to compute the soft terms in the effective Lagrangian, you need to know these are the terms you need to know in the effective action.
I think that's the first term of
S. Yes, yes. And also, so there could be, there's also a term which would correspond to a B term where you have if you had C I C J or something, but those that aren't, I'm not talking about. Or at least give you the B term via the GDH A and the mu term via the B term at zero. Thank you.
point, you're assuming that the whatever the surface breaking scale was is large compared to the application scale. So that you can have a
low complexity. So I'm assuming, and I'm assuming throughout, but basically I've got an n equals 1 supersymmetric. So the moduli potential is given by an n equals 1 supergravity by scalar potential, which is by basically some of the moduli F terms squared, where the moduli F terms are given by so these are all basically the standard formulae of supergravity. And let me also just say that basically M Planck is what? Here. At this point, I really am at white chalk. So,
there are some places on white chalk.
They're tiny. These pieces are too small.
I just brought some new ones in.
Oh, where's the box is all colored chalk here. Oh, thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so given that we have this theory, okay, well, Neil isn't going to like this, but I'm going to say that moduli must be stabilized. And so because we need a potential for the moduli, we need a non-zero superpotential. Because if the superpotential was zero, there wouldn't be any potential, and there isn't any potential, we can't give masses to the moduli.
So what's the last term in the second line? The
-3, what is that? Sorry, m3 half squared. So the square of the gravitational mass. Yeah. And I should also have written that I didn't. The m3 half is e to the k over 2 times w. And this just follows from the, as just a property of the supergravity. Okay, so the moduli potential in general, it breaks supersymmetry. And it almost always Fi is non-zero, and it almost always gives a non-zero gravitino mass. M3 half being non-zero. And typically, it's also the case that moduli masses are comparable to the gravitino mass. I'm not going to defend that statement in a rigorous fashion, because it's possible to cook up models where the moduli masses are significantly heavier than the gravitino mass, but I think in all the cases that I know of, that requires significant fine-tuning. So I'll just leave it as a generic statement that generally moduli masses are comparable to the gravitino mass. In the minimum of the potential, this potential, the mass of the moduli excitations is normally, not significantly higher than the gravitational mass.
I think in the first line, in general breaks symmetry. In the old days, there was a statement that you shouldn't expect potential.
So I wanted to contrast in general and almost always. So in general, let's say almost always say 99% of the time, and in general, all the 50% of the time, or something. It's a common feature that it's a common feature that moduli potentials break supersymmetry, and an almost all examples they give a non-zero gravitational mass. So even the ones normally which preserve supersymmetry, are much have non-zero gravitational masses.
So in the old days, there was an argument that said that supersymmetry should always be generically expected not to be broken because you're solving an equation in an unknown, so there will always be a solution. And in the large volume models, I think that doesn't happen because the solution that you would have found in that way is not in your domain of fluidity or approximations. It's not a large volume. Is there kind of a, do you have a kind of a
I mean, in general, it's just a thing. There are lots of papers in the literature studying moduli stabilization, and in order one proportion of those, the minimum breaks symptom. Yeah,
but that's. If you had to capture why that was true and what was being wrong in the picture of 55 A's, what is it that's wrong? Is that the solution that they led to is not in the domain of fluidity of approximation?
I mean, so I'm not sure what the old argument.
Like in the spirit of saying global supersymmetry, where you're just asking for dw the field equals zero, and so you generically will have a how do you not have minimum? You have to actually work hard not to have a stationary point for a function. So, and then supergravity is more or less if you get n fields and you get n derivatives of w, you'll find a solution to dw di w equals zero. So, it should be hard to you're asking for the absence of a solution.
But there's no reason in general that the you've got a potential with lots of features. I mean, and just because even if you said there exists a Suzy minimum, there's no reason that you're sitting in a Suzy minimum. There's no. I mean, I thought even in these global supersymmetry things, I thought the argument was always that there exists a Suzy minimum of the potential, not that the Suzy minimum is the only minimum of the potential.
Global supersymmetry is clear because if it exists, it's the global minimum.
But there are plenty of they're generically metastable minimums are not hard to.
So is your statement that there are local minima, but they're not the global minima?
Well, I think also in supergravity, the local and global minimum global supersymmetry supersymmetric is zero, and that's clearly the. Whereas in supergravity, I don't see any. I'm not aware of any argument that a supersymmetric minimum should be the global minimum of.
But it's still true that for 20 years there weren't a lot of examples, and so I know that in it is true that the large volume. What's nice about large volume provides examples. And I know in that one case, if you ask why is it an example, what happened? The solution that he would have been led to as the supersymmetric one, the anti-theory space solution or is not a hard place. The KKLP.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into a detail thing about in general, it was intended as a kind of order 50% of the
You have to identify the mechanism.
I don't agree with you, but I don't want to get held up on this. Okay, so moduli masses tend to be so. The Suzy hierarchy problem. Okay, so, one way of putting this is why is M3 half small? Because if you think about all models of, pretty much all models of Suzy breaking, so in gauge mediated models, you'd have a gravitino mass which is much, much less than 1 TeV, and in gravity mediation, you have a gravitino mass which is typically comparable to 1 TeV. In both cases, this is much, much less than 10 to the 18 GeV, which is M Planck. And so a kind of point which I think is important that a single contribution to the superpotential from any sector that is bigger than 10 to the minus 15 in natural units destroys all standard approaches to Suzy breaking. So what this means is that in this moduli potential, if you've got any contribution that's larger than around 10 to the minus 15, then you've got a gravitational mass which is much larger than a TV. And whatever, you know, any approach to supersymmetry breaking with TV scale supersymmetry is pretty much gone away.
Minus 15 is the weak scale?
Yes. Or 10 to minus 15 times M Planck is the weak scale, yes. If you had a contribution to the super potential, which as a number in natural units is larger than 10 to the minus 15.
Two.
No, just 10 to the minus 15.
I think W has dimensions of mass cubed. I mean, it has to be the weak scale times plus the Planck scale square.
Well, so if, you know, if, yeah. So there's, if there's, say there's an M Planck cubed naturally in W. Yeah, so putting M Planck equals 1, then if you have a contribution to W that's larger than 10 to the minus 15, then you're in trouble.
Okay, so that would be like M weak times M Planck squared.
Yeah.
So what is the trouble?
The trouble is that the gravitational mass is larger than a TV. And if the gravitational mass is larger than a TV, then basically, you know, every standard approach to supersymmetry breaking, you know, isn't working. Essentially, because, you know, what your base guesstimate for gravitationally suppressed contributions to the soft terms is larger than a TV, so that you then expect to have soft terms larger than a TV, and so you can't have supersymmetry, so you're addressing the weak hierarchy.
You don't have the potential.
Sorry. Okay. Very, very good. Yeah. This should be. Very good. Yeah, this should be e to the k over 2 times w. Yeah. And in fact, this is the next point. This point is really profound. Okay, so there are two basic ways to address the hierarchy problem, the Suzy hierarchy problem. And this is so profound that I think I can argue that every model in the literature is going to fit into one of these two things. So M3 half is e to the k over 2 times w. So if you want M3 half to be small, you've got two options. You make e to the k over 2 small, or you make w small. Now, that sounds a little silly, but there's a serious point to this. The serious point is that making e to the k over 2 small is essentially lowering all scales in the problem. And in the context of string theory, this is basically M string much, much less than M Planck. And making W small is maintains a high string scale. Okay, so my personal bias is towards lowering all the scales in the problem. A reason for this bias is that if you can get this small, I mean, then you don't have to worry about, you know, if you have some, say, instantonic contribution to the superpotential occurring anywhere in the Calabi-Yau that could make W too large. Because if you make this small, you lower all the scales in the problem. And so whatever goes on in W, pretty much, you're in control. But that's my personal. I think if you had warping to lower the scales, I think that would correspond to the first option, because warping, yeah, is basically lowering the scale, all the scales.
It's also making it true that you don't really have an effective four-dimensional description above the scale if you work out the scale, right? So your whole four-dimensional
This is why I don't work on warping. Okay, so
can you say MS is much less than MV? How much, what order of magnitude, how small does that be the higher?
In the most naive way, the intermediate scale, so around about 10 to the 11 Jev. Okay, so I want to talk about the models of moduli stabilization before I Okay, so flux compactification. So I'm just really going to deal with ineffective theories, yeah, because this is really what I'm. So the Kähler potential with these 2B models. Takes a standard form, which is minus 2 log the volume, part depends on the complex structure, a part depends on the dilaton. And the superpotential is the Gukov-Wafer-Witten form, which is, depends on both S and U. So it's an important note that the superpotential can't depend, at least at three level, on the Kähler moduli because of the shift symmetry of the T moduli, which I was enthused about up there. A second important point is that which I'm going to talk about more later, is that the Kähler potential factorizes into a part that depends on the Kähler moduli plus a part that depends on the complex structure moduli. With at least at tree level, these sectors aren't talking to each other. And this is one example of a kind of a violation of naive effective field theory intuition, and this will be important when talking about flavor and softness.
When you started introducing fluxes or gradients, this is a question I have asked before, then you obviously need that impact direction. You start assuming you have a caveat. Because you could have done the whole thing starting to say, instead of assuming with caveat, start work caveat or RSP structure. And then you redo your multi analysis and you would say, well, there was. Isn't that an alternative way to my expectation? Instead of going on caveat, I'm going to go on a
So okay, so to mind the thing is basically, are the fields light in the effective field theory? So are they, because with these structure manifolds, often it seems that the fields are basically projected out at the compactification scale, and that they get masses around the Kaluza-Klein scale or the string scale. Whereas in something like this, the moduli, they do get masses, but their masses are way below the compactification scale. So the larger one, they're way below the compactification scale or the string scale. So they're still, they're getting masses within the effective four-dimensional theory. Whereas I think with these structure manifolds, as far as I understand them, often that's not happening.
Yeah, and this is also what happened in the strong work, because the KK scales seem order of the same as well. But that's related also. So you always have to assume here that your multiply masses are lower, and you have a mass than the KK scales.
Yes. Yes.
But there's a lot of it. There's no reason for an kernel point of view.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah.
You have to go beyond all.
Yeah, so because with those models, the thing I worry about is so you want to be focusing on the moduli that are remaining in the compactification. And you expect, you really want there to be some moduli remaining in the compactification because, things like gauge couplings, anything more just for the shift symmetry, is always hard to remove at a very high scale. So, I don't understand those models well enough to be confident about what's in the effective theory and what's.
So these
backgrounds,
you just need to make sure that the background.
Yeah, and a large volume, in a large volume, both of those.
It's probably the same question again, but I'm really worried about this issue that you can talk about some moduli and try and stabilize those and not worry about other moduli, particularly when you're bringing in lots of new, you started with some particular moduli spots, maybe H11s and H21s, and the end of this discussion is presumably going to be look at fairs and minimum in this space, but you've done it at the expense of bringing in a whole new space, a whole new component of moduli space, maybe the moduli of these flexes.
But the fluxes don't have moduli.
What about the whole space presumably, you changed the rules, as Lou was saying. No one really talking about the aggregate. You're now just generalized. Space will have moduli. Those things will
happen. No. That I disagree. So the point that, what is about these kind of 2B D3D7 problems? With the flux, originally, there's a 10-dimensional solution to the equation of motion. And the 10-dimensional space is warped for RBA. Sorry, not 10-dimensional. The 6-dimensional space is what will I be at? And in the limit where the, yeah, and with just fluxes, the volume is a free parameter. And the limit where the volume is very large, the back reaction is going to zero, and the warp for RB out is becoming for RB out. So, I mean, to my, the whole advantage, the reason why the D3D7 2B with fluxes is appealing is because it does just inherit the RB out. Which, I mean, the six dimensional space is just looking like a RB out. The warp factor goes to zero in the large volume. Whereas, I mean, these kind of structure manifolds, I mean, the back reaction is so strong that you lose whatever you had in the first place. Whereas with the fluxes, you don't, you have a space which is basically just a Calabi out up to very small corrections when you want equal to a large volume.
But this is an untrue statement that the back reaction, you can do an extension from zero flux and
that's right. Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, it's it's a plus point of these things that there is a 10-dimensional solution of the equations of motion. And so you know that the space is, the 10-dimensional solution is warp plus RB out, and the warp factor goes as base drop 1 plus 1 over volume 2/3.
So, I mean, you say it's still plus RB out up to the very small corrections. Are these small corrections small compared to that 10 to the minus 15 factor? Everything's supposed to be, flat and clubby out up to very, very small corrections.
So the exact theory, the exact 10-dimensional solution, has the basic no scale properties. So, as I see it, what it means is that whatever the warping corrections are, there are corrections to this basic supergravity structure. So that the fact that this supergravity structure has a no scale, has no scale structure, no scale supersymmetry breaking, that whatever the warped corrections to these are, that they're down by, these factors. Well, the fact that the no scale property, it is an exact property of the 10-dimensional thing. So that the no-scale structure is preserved by warping. So I mean, it seems to me that this is this works as a description.
The spirit of what you're saying, you're not assuming the get-go there's no warping, you're saying that you're looking at the type of case of warping, and you're also taking the interest of the large volume limit where that warping happens.
Yes, that's right, I mean, it's a fact of the 10-dimensional solution that the back reaction takes you to warp to RB out, and that the warping is negligible, or it drops off like this in the large volume. Okay, the Cayley potential has got, this Cayley potential has got a no scale structure. So what this means is that V is this, the sum over the Cayley moduli cancels the 3m3/2 squared, and this becomes this over a sum over this, the U and the S moduli. And this has a minimum at DUW equals DSW equals zero. And the properties of that minimum, so the properties of this minimum are basically the no scale properties. And saying out loud, so no scale is characterized by vanishing vacuum energy, broken supersymmetry, and an unfixed direction. So properties are vacuum energy, equals zero. The gravitino mass be zero over volume. The Kähler moduli mass is zero at this level, which is unfixed. The dilaton and U moduli masses are ddw over volume, which is comparable to m3/2 unless there's some fine tuning going on. And Susie is broken in that in the T moduli, so the Kähler moduli have none back, have non-zero effects. Yeah, so I'm just going to define KKLT and then. I can read the clock. Okay, so you need to stabilize the T moduli. So KKLT basically said, suppose there's non-perturbative corrections in the T moduli. These have the effect of breaking the no-scale structure through introducing a dependence on T, and there exists a Susie ADS minimum at DTW is DFW is DUW is zero. The vacuum energy at the gravitino mass is pretty much W0 over V. Susie is unbroken. And unless fine-tuning goes on, in particular unless W0 is fine-tuned to be very small, then the gravitino mass is naturally large and close to the Planck scale. And okay, there's this Susie breaking story involving antibrains, but I think that's quite complicated and messy and a little bit dodgy, so I'm not going to really discuss that.
Do you really have access to the W not being small in this case? I mean, do you trust the solution to break down to the minimum?
I don't try, the W0 being small is just a fine tuning. In case it was always put in as a fine tuning.
Right.
Thing. I mean, there are problems because the volume is always very, very small in these models. So there's various things I think that are not completely trustworthy about. Yeah, or at least it's hard to make trustworthy about the minimum.
So what are A's in your second line?
Just pre-factors of the exponential. They're just numbers. Yeah. Well, they can depend on the complex structure moduli, but...
Sorry, can you spell out what you say untrustworthy?
Okay, so the volume of the space... when you work it out, so because the T has got 1 over G strings, then the volume of the 6th dimensional blobby out is G strings to the 3/2 times the real part of this modulus to the power of 3/2. And in the stabilization, this is balanced against this. So the volume of the 6th dimensional space is G strings to the 3/2 log of this constant W0. So this is the 6th power of the radius. So and given that G string you want, you know, is the string coupling, so this has to be less than 1. And a log, you know, log of anything is small. And you take the sixth root of this to get the radius of the space. This is in string units. So, you know, it's really, really hard. Well, this is always close to 1. And if the radius is close to 1 in string units, then you worry about the level of control.
So let me just ask another question. When you derive the effect of the potential, how would you derive?
So the Kähler potential is derived from basically you have this term in 10 dimensions and you just dimensionally reduce the Einstein-Hilbert. Actually, that's completely awesome. The super potential. I think you can also derive by dimensional. the flux superpotential can be also derived from dimensional reduction. These terms are more, ensuring the existence of these terms is a much more subtle issue. For my purpose, I'm just going to basically assume that they're there.
It's very amazing to me that you can derive the superpotential because your definitions of fields, as I mentioned, are not really, they're not defined in terms of six-dimensional intervals. What sort of miracle happens which will collapse all of that into more simple four-dimensional superpotential?
Okay, so again, with dimensional reduction, so the superpotential basically gives you the gravitational mass. So if you have a 10-dimensional action, and you have some term in that which is involving fluxes, which is on dimensional reduction gives you the 4-dimensional gravitational mass. So you dimensionally reduce that 10-dimensional term to see what the 4-dimensional gravitational mass is. And from that term, that has to be the superpotential. And I think so. That's this is a function of all the complex structure modulus. Okay. I think that's because that's the coefficient of the gravitational mass in the effective action. Originally it was. I think there were these arguments about domain walls and they're probably clever, but a very low tech way of thinking about where this comes from.
So, but the low tech way involves using
to 10 dimensional action dimensionally reduced to the 4 dimensions. Well, we know because it's the superpotential. It wouldn't change the answer because this is the superpotential, and because it's the superpotential, it's exact at tree level and it receives no perturbative corrections. No alpha prime corrections, yeah. Oh, because if the radius is small in string units, okay, you lose complete control over the Cayley potential. Because the Cayley potential isn't protected. And then if that goes,
I think there's a paper that would think it's a flux superpotential dimension reduction.
I think so. I think there are several papers which. Okay, so thank you all for your patience and for asking lots of good questions. So next time, I'm going to start by talking of the large volume models of moduli stabilization, because I didn't quite get there this time. And that will be more at the same time. Thank you.